Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Chat Club, dem Podcast des London Speaker Bureau. Mein Name ist Roland Festring und ich leite das London Speaker Bureau in Deutschland, Österreich und der Schweiz. Das London Speaker Bureau zählt zu den international führenden Referentenagenturen mit 20 Büros weltweit. Wenn Ihnen dieser Podcast gefällt, können Sie ihn auch abonnieren. Weitere Informationen dazu finden Sie auch bei uns auf der Website unter londonspeakerbureau.de/podcast. I'm very happy to meet José Manuel Barroso, the former president of the European Commission, and prior to that he was the Prime Minister of Portugal as well as the Foreign Minister. Currently is affiliated with a financial institution and the president, the global president of Gavi, which is the Global Alliance of Vaccine. A very warm welcome, Mr. Barroso.
My pleasure.
Mr. Barroso is probably one of the very few people in Europe who can comment on the European relationships with the rest of the world from a political, from an economic, and from a business point of view. And so what is your current assessment of Europe or the European Union, Mr. Barroso, considering the severe challenges that we are meeting?
Europe is more vulnerable than others to the current situation, namely on issues of energy. At the same time, if you think about European integration as a process, quite instinctively, the reality is that Europe is making progress as a response to the financial sovereign debt crisis. We created institutions that were unthinkable before that financial and sovereign debt crisis. As a response to pandemic, for the first time there was some kind of debt mutualization, the European Union raising funds in the global markets, and now as a response to the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, the European Union is including work in the fields of defense. So it shows that sometimes in Europe a crisis is necessary for Europe to go forward. Having said that, in the current moment, because of the huge challenges represented mainly by the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and the possible process of decoupling, so some kind of deglobalization, Europe is more vulnerable than some of our partners, precisely because Europe, more than others, depends from open markets, and also depends from relatively affordable energy.
Now, you mentioned the invasion, the Russian invasion in the Ukraine. So that certainly is a major challenge for Europe. Is it really perceived rather a major challenge in Europe, or would you consider it a global challenge?
It's for Europe and for the world. It would be a mistake. And I've been speaking with many people outside Europe, namely in the Americas, but also Asia, and some of them tend to think that's basically a European problem, you should sort it out. But it's not a European problem as well. Only, it's a problem that has, first of all, a possibility of escalation. And I don't want to sound catastrophic, but we saw in the past that two European wars became two world wars. And we should not forget that. But also, there are huge ramifications, namely the field of energy, in the field of food security. And there is, in fact, behind this conflict between, let's call it, Russia and the West, there is the possibility of a full decoupling with China. China being, of course, of a complete different magnitude. So we may be facing a possibility, or rather the probability, of a global decoupling, what I call the great decoupling. So this is indeed critically important for Europe, first of all, for the Ukrainians, because they are being invaded. For Russia also, they are, I believe, paying a huge cost because of what's happening. For the European stability, certainly, but for the Eurasia continent, if you want to think in terms of Eurasia, but for the world stability. Not only because there is a violation of a principle of territorial integrity and national sovereignty that, of course, if not respected, can generate much, much more instability, but also because of the very concrete economic, financial consequences that we are already seeing.
Now, you mentioned the European and Russian relationship, so we all hope that the war will be over very soon, but nobody knows. But what is kind of a post-war scenario between Europe and Russia? Because a lot of damage has been done.
Look, as you know, Roland, I've met President Putin, I think, more than 20 times at least, because of my role as President of the European Commission. At that time, we had twice a year summits with Russia. So I think I know somehow Putin. And for me, it is difficult to see how he can accept a defeat. At the same time, Ukrainians, with great courage, are showing a great determination in defending their own country. So when I speak with many people around the world, my conclusion is that nobody knows what's going to happen. It's not clear what can be the landing zone of this conflict. That is why we have seen what you could call until now a stalemate. Sometimes it appears that one party has an advantage, sometimes it appears the other one is replying. But what can be the settlement? It's not clear. For me, one thing is clear, is that Russia is a fact. Russia will be there for the future. But I hope that by now also Putin understands that Ukraine is a fact. And so some kind of agreement should be attempted. That's why, as someone has said, we should not consider diplomacy a dirty word. We should think about what can be a possible settlement to bring peace. First of all, to avoid so many people dying, young people dying in those countries, but also, namely, in a country that has been aggressed, that is Ukraine, but also to bring stability to Europe.
So you mentioned that you probably are the European politician who met Putin more often than anybody else and had major negotiations with him. Do you think it's realistic that Putin will kind of survive politically and that he will be the one to do a peace treaty with?
That's exactly the question. There are some people believe that because of what seems until this moment a very strong reaction and in some way some kind of tactical advantage of Ukraine, that Putin may be replaced, that there will be a change in the regime in Russia, even if, for instance, the United States have been very clear saying that their goal is not regime change in Russia. My prudent observation is the following. We never know what follows. Will it be better? Will it be worse? We really don't know. So I don't think we should bet on changes of regime. I think we should work for, of course, first of all, we have to support Ukraine for obvious reasons, because if now we accept the principle that one country, in this case the biggest country in the world, on the planet, that is Russia, from a geographical point of view, by far the biggest country on the planet, can take parts of other country that is smaller, I mean, then we have a real problem for stability in Europe and beyond. But at the same time, we should be thinking about what could be the possible security guarantees that could shape some accommodation. I have no illusions. I'm not naive. I don't think a true reconciliation is going to happen in the foreseeable future, as we had after the Second World War. We had, I believe, by the way, thanks to the European community as well, true reconciliation between former enemies. I don't think that will happen, but I think it could happen to have some kind of arrangement that allows some level of stability. And my concern is that I do not see enough thinking on this area.
Now, in one sentence, how would you describe the best scenario in Europe that will help, in what shape Europe will be in 2025, in 3 years' time, roundabout?
To have this war stopped, to have it, at the minimum, a ceasefire, or some kind of frozen conflict, as some people say, to use a word that unfortunately we have been using for other conflicts, if possible, of course, with an agreement on some security, global security arrangements for Europe. By the way, from that point of view, that European conference that took place some time ago was a good idea. And we have to have beyond European Union some ideas about European security and stability. And I think that would be the possible realistic scenario.
Another world leader you have met several times, probably again more often than anybody else in Europe, is President Xi in China, as well as his predecessors in China. So you know China very well on a political level. What is the relationship between Europe and China? Is there a relationship Europe-China, or is it rather a relationship between the individual European countries and China?
There is a relation between the European Union and China, but today also in crisis. There was, in fact, it was launched still with myself leading the European Commission, negotiations for an investment agreement. These negotiations were concluded some time ago, in fact, during the German presidency. But afterwards, because of sanctions and counter-sanctions, because of the Uyghur issue, they were put in the freeze, let's say, like that. So, and today, the European Union, as such, relations with China are difficult, as are the relations of the United States with China or others with China. It's not only the only case. At the same time, I would say that the European Union would like to keep some kind of relationship with China. Once again, more tension than before. It is no longer, to be honest, the strategic partnership that some people were mentioning some years ago. It's the recognition that in some areas there is space for partnership, for instance, fighting against climate change, cooperating in response to pandemics, so-called cooperation for global public goods, but there is competition in some areas, including the economic areas, and also there is, in fact, sometimes even some rivalry for strategic or global influence. For me, the important thing would be to have certainly competition, but without confrontation. And I continue to think that it is important to keep the dialogue open with China in the interest not only of Europe, but also in the interest of the global community, because China is one, in terms of nation states, is the second more important economy in the world and critically important from a trade in point of view.
And there's no European country who could do without trade with China. And so we can't replace it. So what is the alternative when people kind of say, well, we want to cut down dealings with China?
I think that to some extent decoupling with China is already happening. We see that in the technological sector. We saw the case of Huawei. We see in some areas, for instance, between the United States and China, and it is clearly the most important rivalry today in the world is the United States and China. I insist, much more important than the current conflict with Russia. So some decoupling is already happening. And also many companies, at least from a risk management point of view, are withdrawing from China or reducing their exposure to China. I mean, Western companies. And I think that is going to continue. The minimum we could hopefully try to achieve is to keep the doors open for trade, because if not, it will be self-defeating for all of us and also for the world economy. And also, and now I refer also to the experience I had in the G20, I was in all those summits since 2008 in the G20. At that time, of course, there were differences ideological and political divergences, but the dialogue was going on when it was the time to discuss some global issues. Once again, climate change. It's impossible to have a solution for climate change without having the biggest economy, one of the two biggest economies agreeing. So this is the difficulty. By the way, that's for all, That's why we did diplomacy. For some reason, there is diplomacy. Diplomacy is not just to speak with our friends. Diplomacy is to speak with those sometimes with whom we have big differences.
Now, and that's a very good hint, because the U.S., they are our biggest ally in the Western world, of course. But the relationship between the European Union and, of course, every single country in Europe and the United States has changed substantially during the last 10 years, one can say. Are we rather friends or are we rather competitors?
I may be biased, but I continue to think we are friends and we should remain friends, especially now when we see in so many parts of the world the rise of authoritarianism or even totalitarianism. There are differences between the United States and Europe, but basically we share the same values of, let's say, open societies and open economies. But you are right, there have been difficult moments, namely the Trump presidency created a lot of mistrust in Europe, and I think we still are living some of the effects of this issue. When, for instance, the United States were the only country to leave the Paris Agreement on climate change, but also the tone. Let's not forget that very often President Trump was much more aggressive against the European Union, against Germany, I remember against Chancellor Merkel, than at the same time that he was saying nice things not only with President Putin or the leader of North Korea. So it's just a little bit strange, isn't it? So, and I think it was the lowest moment in the transatlantic relationship, including on NATO. Now, apparently the relationship was able to resist to all these tensions. Today, the political relationship between the current administration in Washington and the European Union is very good. I know that. I know people from both sides. And in fact, it's very, very good. But, to be honest, there are some concerns in Europe regarding some measures in the U.S. that can have a clear protectionist effect, that are in fact encouraging some of the European industries to move on that direction or to the Americas, including to NAFTA. So, and this is a problem. So now they are discussing. I hope that these differences, because there are differences, let's not fool ourselves, there are, can be solved in a way that basically the United States and Europe stay along the same lines. The current administration has understood clearly that the United States need alliances. They cannot, on their own, they cannot, defend all their interests and project their values. So, and Europe, besides being united itself, that's of course for me a precondition, should also understand that we need to work with others, and certainly the United States are like-minded, basically, and it is important also for security and defense reasons that we keep a very good level of cooperation.
So now, there is a scenario that President Trump will return in 24, and so what is then, or do you consider it likely that eventually the Europeans have to decide between who's our friends, who are competitors, who's our enemy, because on the political side as well as economically, we might have to decide between China or the USA?
I hope that moment will not come, but I believe that if the moment comes of decision, if the Europeans will have to decide between the US and China, they will decide the side of the US, also because of security guarantees. Most European countries, a huge majority are NATO members, and most NATO members are the European Union members. Let's not forget that. So, but precisely one of the things that European Union countries and European as such usually does not like to do is to decide. By definition, the European is a compromise, and we try to integrate different sensitivities. So, and this is part of the challenge we have today. So how can we be loyal allies and work together in some matters at the same time have some positions that are not exactly the same? And this is sometimes very, very challenging.
Well, I think we could go on for an hour and a half easily, but we have to stop here. Thank you very much indeed for telling me what your expectations are, what the outlooks are.
Sollte Ihnen unser Podcast gefallen, können Sie diesen abonnieren auf Spotify, Deezer, Apple oder Google oder auf Ihrer Lieblingsplattform. Fragen und Anregungen gerne an podcast@londonspeakerbureau.de.